Now, hold your head high and never be forced to rely on someone else to put food on your table. Dad toasted me and offered plenty of fatherly advice. It's mostly men studying at university, and they won't expect you to be as smart as they are. But I know that you can do as well as, or better than, any man. Because you are Tutsi, getting to university has been a battle. But the hard part is over. Now it's up to you. Study hard and pray. My heart swelled at his sweet, tender words. Don't worry, Dad, I said. I won't let you or Mom down. I'll make you proud. I wanted to study psychology or philosophy so that I could learn about the inner workings of the human heart and mind, but the scholarships were limited to open spaces in specific programs, and I wasn't allowed to choose my own major. The government assigned me to the applied science program, which was fine. I'd push myself at lycée to excel in math and physics to show up my brothers, and now it would pay off. I packed my bags and was soon off to Butare, 4 hours southeast of my village, and a whole new life away. I loved my classes and studied hard, but I also enjoyed the fun and freedom of being at university. My scholarship included a monthly allowance, which was the equivalent of 30 American dollars, a fortune to me. For the first time in my life, I felt independent, like a grown-up. It was exhilarating. My social life was very active, including gatherings at coffee shops, movies on the weekends, and campus dances every other Saturday night. I joined the drama club, singing and dancing in all the productions, which were often attended by the mayor of Butare. My favorite roles were the religious ones, and once I even got to portray my favorite saint, the Virgin Mary, and I always made time to pray. More and more, I found that devotion and meditation balanced me and helped me focus. I attended church several times a week and formed a prayer group with my girlfriends. My first 2 years at university flew by, and all was well. My grades were good, my family was healthy, and my life was fun and exciting. In fact, life was so good that it was sometimes easy to forget there was a war going on, while other times it was impossible to forget. Despite on-again, off-again peace talks and ceasefires, the fierce fighting between the Tutsi rebels and government troops continued in the north. Radical political parties were springing up in many towns and cities, each violently opposed to the others. Unemployed young men flocked to the youth wings of the different parties because they had nothing better to do. Many were just street gang members who joined the parties for free drugs and alcohol. President Habyarimana's own political party organized a youth movement called the Interahamwe, which means those who attack together. The Interahamwe attracted thousands of homeless kids, and its membership spread across the country like a virus. It became the Hutu Extremist Militia, and many of its members were trained to fight and kill by government army soldiers. They traveled in packs and wore informal uniforms, baggy print shirts of bright red, yellow, and green that resembled the flag of their political party. But no matter how much they organized, I always viewed them as lawless street thugs. President Habyarimana traveled to Tanzania and signed a peace agreement with the Tutsi rebels. The agreement would end the civil war and give Tutsis a role in governing the country. It sounded wonderful. I thought that Rwanda might find peace and that Tutsis and Hutus could finally live in harmony as equals. But the promise of peace triggered more protests and threats of greater violence to come. The minute the agreement was signed, one of Rwanda's most powerful military officers, a scary-looking colonel named Tonyes Bagasora, who was also the chief leader of the Interahamwe, stormed out of the talks. Bagasora was disgusted by seeing President Habyarimana shake hands with RPF leader Paul Kagame, whom he called a Tutsi snake. He vowed that he'd never make peace with the Tutsis and promised to return to Rwanda to prepare an apocalypse. And that's exactly what he did. Chapter 5, Returning Home. Too many mornings I awoke to the sound of hatred. I'd sleep peacefully until the obnoxious sounds of RTLM drifted through my dorm window and into my dreams. You see, in my third year at university, RTLM became the new ultra-popular radio station among extremist Hutus. It was little more than a radical hate machine, spewing out anti-Tutsi venom. It was always some disembodied, malevolent voice calling for Hutu power, the catchphrase for Hutus to rise up against their Tutsi friends and neighbors. These Tutsi cockroaches are out to kill us. Do not trust them. We Hutus must act fast. They are planning to take over our government and persecute us. If anything happens to our president, then we must exterminate all the Tutsis right away. Every Hutu must join together to rid Rwanda of these Tutsi cockroaches. Hutu power! Hutu power! It was an awful way to wake up. The broadcast was so ridiculously juvenile. It was hard to believe that anyone could take the infantile insults and outlandish threats seriously. Still, it was unsettling to know that the government was allowing Tutsis to be openly threatened over the public airwaves. But at the time, I was more disturbed by rumors that Tutsis were being murdered by extremists in several areas of the country. Like my friends on campus, I tried not to dwell on the media reports. Easter was approaching, and it was always a special time for my family. We'd spend it together, at home, entertaining neighbors and visiting friends and relatives. I planned to spend 6 days with my parents and be back at school for my exams at the end of the week. I arrived in Mataba on Saturday afternoon, and my parents were overjoyed to have me home. The entire family was there, with the exception of Imable, who'd won an international scholarship to do postgraduate work in science. He'd actually left the country to study in Senegal, more than 3,000 miles away. Damascene had traveled down from Kigali, where he'd been teaching high school since graduating with his master's degree in history, and Vianney was home on vacation from boarding school. I spent the first day back catching up on local gossip with Damascene, visiting friends, and arguing playfully with Vianney. The next day was Easter Sunday, and we had a beautiful meal together. We thanked God for all that He had blessed us with and prayed for the well-being of everyone in our family and our village. Despite the political tension in the air, we were having a great time. I felt safe and secure with my parents, knowing that whatever might happen, my mother would be there to comfort us and my dad would be there to protect us. At least, that's what I thought. It was such a typical evening that it was hard to believe our world was about to change forever. We were sitting in the living room chatting about school, work, and what had been happening in the village. I relaxed and took it all in, happy just to be home. The only person who wasn't having a good time was Damascene. He was usually the life of the party, but he'd been pensive and anxious all evening. Damascene, what's wrong with you tonight? I asked. My brother looked up at me, and when our eyes met, he couldn't keep quiet any longer. He unburdened himself to me in a rush of words and emotion.
Immaculée, I saw them. I saw the killers. I was on my way to Bone's house, and we saw them in the distance. They were wearing the bright colors of the Interahamwe and were carrying hand grenades. They had grenades, Immaculée.
The room had grown silent, since everyone had overheard him. My parents looked at each other, then back at Damascene.
"Maybe you're letting your imagination get the better of you," my father said, trying to calm his son down. "There is a lot of dangerous talk going on, and people are seeing danger where there is none."
"No, I'm not imagining things," Damascene said, getting to his feet and speaking with urgency. "And that's not all I saw. They have a list of names of all the Tutsi families in the area, and our names are on it. It's a death list. They are planning to start killing everyone on the list tonight."
Damascene paced around the room and began pleading with my father.
"Dad, we have to leave, please. We have to get out of here while we still can. We can just walk down the hill, find a boat, cross Lake Kivu, and be safely in Zaire by midnight. But we have to leave now before it's too late."
Damascene's outburst was so sudden and out of character.
"Hold on, Damascene. Just settle down a minute," my father said. "You're upsetting your mother and sister. If you make decisions when you're panicked or afraid, you make mistakes. Your nerves are making things seem worse than they are. I've seen this situation before. You hear rumors of death squads and stories about death lists. But after a few days, you realize it has all been greatly exaggerated. We are not going to abandon our home and everything we've worked for because nervous people have vivid imaginations. Things are getting better for the government, and there will be peace soon. Don't worry. Let's just stay calm and enjoy the holidays. There is no death list and no one is coming to kill us. I'm older and I know better," my father said with a weak smile.
"Now, for heaven's sake, let's sit down and eat dinner together."
My father's assurances temporarily convinced me that all would be fine, and we all gathered around the dining room table to eat. I sensed that Damascene was unmoved by our father's arguments. Behind his beautiful open smile, my brother was deeply troubled. I wish I had known that that night was to be our last family supper together. I would have stood up and thanked God for all of them. I would have told everyone sitting around that table how much I loved them and thanked them for loving me. But I didn't know. Before we went to bed, we said evening prayers together as a family, as we'd always done. My mother kissed us goodnight, and my father promised that nothing bad would happen and wished us a peaceful sleep. My bedroom was like my own little chapel. With my Bible and statues of Jesus and the Virgin Mary on my night table, it was a place where I connected with God and my own spiritual energies. I knelt by my bed and looked at the statues, saying a prayer to God to protect my family from danger. I turned out my light and tried to sleep. My eyes were shut for what only seemed like minutes when the door of my room burst open. I sat up with a start and noticed that it was dawn. I could see Damascene's terrified face in the gray half-light of my bedroom, and I imagined the worst.
"What is it, Damascene? Are the killers here?"
I whispered. I could barely hear my own frightened voice. My brother said nothing. I could hear him trying to catch his breath while he stood in the doorway. When he finally spoke, his voice sounded like it was coming to me from the bottom of a deep well.
"Get up, Immaculée. For heaven's sake, get up! The president is dead."
"What?
What do you mean the president is dead?" I cried out.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing. The president had promised to bring peace and equality back to Rwanda. How could he be dead?
"I mean President Habyarimana is dead. He was killed last night. His plane was shot out of the sky."
I thought of what I'd heard on the radio a few days before.
If anything happens to our president, then all Tutsis must be exterminated.
I jumped out of bed and searched frantically for something to wear. The president has been killed. Someone's killed the president, I kept mumbling to myself in dazed disbelief. Dropping onto the bed, I said, Oh, Damasin, we are all going to die. They will come for us now and will kill us for sure. My brother sat down and put his arms around me.
Listen to me, Immaculée. We are not going to die, he firmly stated. We had nothing to do with this. The president was flying back from peace talks in Tanzania, and he was traveling with the president of Burundi. The plane was shot down when it was landing in Kigali. In Kigali! No one will be blaming us down here.
Damasin was trying to be brave for me, but he was a poor actor. I know that he was trying to convince himself as much as me.
Maybe things will improve for us now that he's dead, he continued. So many people were against these peace negotiations and President Habyarimana's plans for a more moderate government that his death may actually ease the tensions. So don't be so frightened, Immaculée. Come outside. Everyone is out there listening to the radio.
He took me by the hand, and we went out into the yard where my parents had settled in to listen to the radio. The announcer reported that roadblocks and military checkpoints had been set up all over the capital, minutes after the president's plane had blown up. He also said that at least 20 Tutsi families in Kigali had been killed during the night. I hesitate to use the word reported, because the man on the radio sounded more like a cheerleader for the killers than a journalist. When he announced that presidential guard soldiers had taken it upon themselves to kill Tutsis to avenge the president's death, he made the killing sound justified. He made it sound like dragging entire families into the street and murdering them was perfectly reasonable. Then he read out some of the names of the people soldiers had killed so far in Kigali. The fifth name belonged to my uncle Twaza.
They've killed Twaza!
My mother cried out, quickly covering her eyes with her hands and shaking her head in disbelief.
Why would they kill Twaza? He's never harmed anyone!
A painful silence enveloped my family as we realized that we'd missed our opportunity to escape the night before. My father tried again to ease our fears.
Emotions are running very high in the capital. That's where the killings are, because that's where most of the soldiers are based, he said matter-of-factly. Everything will settle down in a day or two. You'll see.
A few minutes later, our suspicions were confirmed in a series of radio announcements.
Stay in your homes. It is forbidden to travel. Only military personnel will be allowed in the streets. Do not go outside. Public transportation has been suspended. Do not leave your homes.
They want us to stay put so they'll know where to find us. They want us to be sitting ducks,
Damasin exclaimed, eyes widening.
If our names are on their death list, then they'll know where we live and they know we will be here.
It was the morning of April 7th, 1994. We didn't know it yet, but the genocide had begun. Chapter 6 No going back. Mom, Dad, Damasin, Vieni, and I spent the entire day huddled together in our yard listening to the radio. The broadcasts from outside of Rwanda reported that ordinary Hutu citizens were joining government soldiers and Interahamwe militiamen and killing innocent Tutsi civilians. Meanwhile, the local stations were encouraging Hutus to pick up machetes and attack their Tutsi neighbors. The national radio station continued to warn people to remain in their homes, and like good children, we obeyed. We were too afraid to open our gate to find out what was happening on the other side of the fence. We placed ourselves under self-imposed house arrest, worried that stepping beyond our property line could prove fatal. My family didn't own a telephone, and even if we had, most of the phone lines in the country were down. We were completely cut off, except for whatever the radio told us. We sat listening to the horrific reports for hours until I thought I'd go out of my mind. Late in the afternoon, I pulled out my books and began studying for my exams.
"How do you do it, Immaculée?"
Damascene asked.
"Where do you find the strength to study? Why do you believe that there will even be a school to go back to?"
My brother had helped me shake my own despair only hours earlier, but now he, too, was hopeless. It was my turn to be strong.
"Stop worrying," I said. "We'll get through this. If things get bad, we'll slip across the border. Have faith."
The truth was that I had little faith myself. I wasn't studying to prepare for exams, but to keep my mind off my family's worries. The only encouraging news we heard all day was a message from the RPF's Paul Kagame, who was in charge of the Tutsi rebel soldiers based in Uganda. He promised that if the killing of Tutsis didn't stop, the rebels would invade Rwanda and fight to the death to protect their fellow Tutsis. It was comforting to hear Kagame say that, but I was saddened that the only good news was the threat of all-out war. None of us slept more than a few minutes that night. The next day, we listened to a BBC phone interview with Rwanda's Prime Minister, Agathe Uwilingiyimana, a moderate Hutu living in Kigali. Even though United Nations peacekeepers were guarding her, there was gunfire all around her home. She said that she, her husband, and their five children were lying on the floor and had no way to escape. During the interview, the phone line went dead. We learned later that soldiers had burst into her home and shot both her and her husband. The Prime Minister's words affected us deeply, and it was now impossible to pretend that things were going to get better. If killers could execute the Hutu Prime Minister, what would stop them from murdering us? The constant tension during those 24 hours took a toll on my family. My mother went into a kind of trance and began moving from room to room, packing every suitcase we owned with whatever she could lay her hands on.
"I am not going to leave the things I've worked hard for so people can steal them," she told us. "I'm going to hide them away. One day we'll come back for them."
I didn't know where she was planning to go. We'd just heard over the radio that our only practical escape route, across Lake Kivu, had been cut off by the Interahamwe militia. They were murdering every Tutsi or moderate Hutu who approached the lake. My father remained in bewildered denial.
"If the killing continues," he reasoned, "the RPF will step in to stop it. They could be here in Mataba to protect us in a few days."
"Daddy, what are you thinking?" I asked him, incredulous. "The RPF soldiers are up north near the Ugandan border. They have no vehicles. They're on foot and will have to fight the army and Interahamwe every step of the way. It will take weeks for them to get here, if they get here at all." I could count the number of times I'd contradicted my father on one hand, but everything was changing. My parents weren't thinking clearly. I'd followed Damascene's lead my entire life, but now he'd retreated to his room and was staring at the walls.
"Do you honestly think we're going to escape this?" he asked when I came to find him. "I'm lying here trying to picture what I'll be doing next year. But I can't. I don't think I'll be alive. I have no future."
"Damascene, you have to snap out of this," I shouted. "You can't give up before we even start to fight. If you can't see what you'll be doing next year, I can.
You'll be with me in Butari when I graduate university. You're going to be sitting in the front row, clapping and cheering when I accept my diploma. So please, get up and help Mom and Dad.
I wish I had your faith and courage, he muttered, then continued staring at the wall. I didn't feel courageous, but someone had to pull my family together. I tried to be strong and at least act brave so that the family wouldn't collapse in complete despair. By nightfall, we'd heard that the 10 Belgian UN peacekeepers protecting the prime minister had been murdered by the government soldiers and that the lives of all other Belgians in Rwanda were being threatened. We knew that if the Belgians and other foreigners left the country, there would be no one capable of stopping an all-out slaughter. For the second night in a row, none of us slept. At dawn, the screaming began. 2 dozen Interahamwe militiamen attacked our village, tossing grenades into houses. When the families inside tried to escape, they were hacked to death with machetes. When my family heard the screams, we opened our gate and ran out to the road. We could see for quite a distance from our hilltop home and searched for the source of the commotion. Below us, on the far side of a nearby river, we saw a group of Interahamwe surrounding one of our neighbors. They moved like a pack of jackals, holding their machetes above their heads and circling him slowly. We watched, helplessly from afar, as they moved in for the kill, mercilessly chopping him to bits. We turned away from the murder in horror. Coming toward us quickly from the other side of the hill were dozens of our Tutsi neighbors. The men were carrying sticks and stones to protect their families, while the women carried their babies in their arms and yelled at their older kids not to fall behind.
Leonard! Leonard!
They called when they saw my father.
Please help us! They're killing us! What will we do? Where should we go?
Since my father was one of the most respected men in the village, within a few hours, approximately 2,000 men, women, and children were camped out in front of our house, looking to him for guidance. I couldn't believe how many people had been driven from their homes. Scores of families sat around cooking fires, arguing about what to do next, while their children played games and chased each other through the fields. The number of people who had come seeking my father's help and advice seemed to bring him back to reality. He became more like himself and took action.
Everyone be calm, he said. We'll find a way to get through this together.
That night, my father told me he was concerned for my health.
You haven't slept at all, Immaculée. The rest of us are going to stay outside tonight with the others, so I want you to go to your room and get some sleep.
I didn't like the idea of staying in the house alone. I was terrified that we'd be attacked in the night. He saw my hesitation and smiled.
Don't worry, my sweetheart. I'm here, and I'm going to protect you. It's cold outside, and you need to get some rest. Now go inside and lie down.
I knew that he couldn't protect me against the Interahamwe, but I couldn't bear to hurt his pride, so I did as he said. My mother promised that she'd stand guard over the house to make sure I was safe. Despite my parents' love and concern, I couldn't sleep at all that night either. I kept a small radio on my chest, spinning the dial until dawn and listening to report after report of what was happening around us. The news got worse as the night wore on. Tutsis were being killed in large numbers in every corner of Rwanda. Peace talks between the government and Tutsi rebels had broken off,
and the RPF vowed to fight its way to the capital to stop the slaughter. In the middle of the night, I went outside and found my mother asleep in the courtyard. She dozed off guarding our front door. When I moved closer to wake her, my breath caught in my throat. She was wrapped in a white bedsheet, and in the cold moonlight, she looked like a corpse. I was overwhelmed by the sight and ran back to my room. I fell into my bed, and for the first time since our nightmare began, I burst into tears. "Why is this happening?" I cried into my pillow. "What have we done to deserve this? Why is being a Tutsi so wrong? Why are you letting this happen to us, God?" I felt selfish for crying and dried my eyes. "Silly girl," I thought. "Cry later. This tragedy is just beginning, and there will be plenty of time for tears." I returned outside just as the sun was beginning to rise over Lake Kivu and stood beside my sleeping mother. I softly stroked her feet and carefully unknotted the tangles in her hair. Mother was always so beautiful and proud of her appearance. She'd be mortified to be seen in such a state. I kissed her cheek and gently shook her awake. "Mom, get up," I said softly. "It's cold out here. Get into bed." As soon as she opened her eyes, they filled with fear and confusion.
"Where's Damasin? Where is Vieni? Immaculée, you should be in the house getting rest. What are you doing outside alone in the dark?"
she asked, struggling to get up.
"What are you doing out here, Mom?"
"I didn't want to leave you alone in the house, but I didn't want to be too far away from your father and my boys. I have to make sure everyone is safe."
"Everyone is safe, Mom. The boys and Dad are camping out with the others. Maybe things will get better today," I said, my heart aching from the pain etched on her face.
She'd worked and sacrificed for us her entire life and spent countless hours worrying about our safety. Now she knew she couldn't do anything to protect us, and it was killing her. She seemed to have aged years during the past few days. We went looking for my father and brothers, who were with the refugees, and we weren't prepared for what we found when we stepped outside. At least 10,000 Tutsis were camped in front of our home. My father was walking through the huge crowd, greeting people with words of encouragement. He'd been up all night and refused to go inside and rest. Dozens of people were trying to reach him, but there were so many that it was impossible for him to talk to them all. Finally, he climbed to the top of a large boulder at the base of a cliff and turned to the frightened crowd.
"Friends! Friends!" he shouted. "I know you're afraid. Don't be. These people, these killers, are few and we are many. They're not stronger than we are, not if we have God's love in our hearts. If they are acting out of evil, for no reason other than their hatred for us, then we will defeat them. Love will always conquer hatred. Believe in yourselves, believe in each other, and believe in God."
My heart swelled with pride. It was hard to believe that this was the same man who had seemed so confused and unreasonable just hours before. Yet here he was, passing his strength on to so many lost and terrified souls.
"If these killers are driven only by hatred, we will force them away. But if the government is sending them, if these attacks are part of an organized plan to exterminate Tutsis, we are in serious trouble. The government has guns and grenades. It has an army and a militia. And we have no weapons at all.
if the government plans to kill us. All we can do is pray. Let us use the time we have to repent. Let us pray for God to forgive our sins. If we are to die, let us die with our hearts clean.
The cheering stopped and the crowd was silent. At first, I thought that my father had crushed their spirits, but I realized that thousands of them had taken his advice and were quietly praying.
It doesn't matter if we live or die. The important thing is that we fight against this evil that has come to our homes.
My dad cried out. He lifted his right hand high above his head. I could see that he was holding his red and white rosary.
We will ask God to defend us against evil, he shouted, waving the rosary in the air.
Then he reached down and picked up a long metal-tipped spear with his left hand. He lifted the spear about his head as well and continued.
We will ask God for help, but we will also defend ourselves. Find a spear. Arm yourselves, but don't kill anyone. We won't be like them. We will not kill, but we won't sit around and be slaughtered like sheep either. Let us be strong, and let us pray.
A few hours after my father's speech, 50 Interahamwe, armed with knives and machetes, attacked the Tutsis outside our home. My father gathered more than 100 Tutsi men together and rushed toward the killers. When they got within throwing distance, they tossed stones at them and eventually chased them away. But it was a minor victory. The radio continued to report widespread killings, and a steady stream of Tutsi refugees was arriving at our door. Each new arrival had a new horror story. From what they told us, we realized that we were completely surrounded by the Interahamwe. After the attack, I went to my bedroom to get my scapular, a kind of cloth necklace that Catholics wear. The scapular is very precious to me because it's blessed with the Virgin Mary's promise that whosoever dies wearing it shall not suffer eternal fire. It shall be a sign of salvation, a protection in danger, and a pledge of peace. I bought it when I moved away to university, believing that if anything happened to me, my scapula would speed my journey to heaven. I went to my father's study, where he'd gone after chasing off the Interahamwe. He was rummaging through his desk and sticking family photos into his pockets. Dad, I have something for you, I said, holding out the scapular. He knew what it was and what it was for.
Why don't you leave it in the house? That way no one will burn it down, he said.
My eyes filled with tears. No, Dad. You have to wear this. Who is the person in this family putting himself in danger? Who is the most likely to be killed in all of this, Dad? Stop worrying about the house. It's your spirit that matters now, not material things.
All right, Immaculate. I understand, he said,
taking the scapular from my hand and putting it around his neck.
Now, what do I have for you? What can I give my only daughter?
He wondered aloud, rifling through his desk.
Ah, of course. I know exactly what to give you.
He reached into his shirt pocket and pulled out the red and white rosary he'd shown to the crowd. He pressed the beads into my palm and covered my hand with his.
Keep it always immaculate.
As soon as we exchanged gifts, our front door banged open, and a neighborhood woman began yelling desperately for my father.
Leonard! Leonard! Please come quickly! They're back! The killers are back, but there are many, many more of them now!
My father ran to his bedroom, grabbed a spear that he had hidden under his bed, and charged out the door. I followed him as best I could, but my legs felt like rubber. I thought that we were about to die, especially when I saw that the killers were standing about a quarter mile from our house.
Let's fight these wicked people! Let's stop this senseless killing! They might kill us, but we'll die pure of heart!
My father cried out, trying to rally other Tutsi men to his side. No one joined him. Dad was sweating, and his eyes were wide and wild. He began running toward the killers by himself, holding his spear high in the air. My mother flew after him, her long blue dress flapping behind her. She grabbed hold of his shirt tail and dug her heels into the earth. He kept running, dragging her behind him as she screamed out his name.
Stop, Leonard! Stop! You can't fight them alone! Please! Please! Please let someone else go! There are so many young men here! Let them fight!
She begged. Everyone was staring at her, but she didn't care. She saw her husband of 28 years, a man she loved above all others, running towards certain death, and she was going to do everything in her power to stop him. Dad ran out of breath and was unable to drag Mom behind him any farther. He stopped and tried to catch his breath while his wife clung to his shirt.
What is wrong with you?
She shrieked at the younger Tutsis in the crowd.
How can you let your elders fight your battles for you? How can you let my husband get killed for you? Be men! Get up and fight!
People stared at her but made no move to help because they were all terrified. My mother turned to my father, wrapped her arms around him and pleaded,
Don't go, Leonard. Please! Listen to me, Rose.
Dad gripped her by the shoulders.
It is my duty to be here for these people right now. If that means fighting, then I will fight. I have to do what I feel is right. Now stop panicking and go help the young mothers with their children. I'll be back.
By the time my parents finished arguing, the killers had left. I suppose that as they got closer, they got a better sense of just how many Tutsis were actually at our house. Even with guns and grenades, 100 against 10,000 were not good odds. But the odds would not be in our favor for long. After my parents' skirmish in front of the house, Damasin came to see me. His eyes were bloodshot and his voice was strained.
The killers ran away this time, Immaculée, but they'll come back. And when they do, there will be too many of them to chase away with sticks and stones. If they catch you, they will rape you first, then kill you. You have to leave. Go stay with Pastor Murinzi. I'm sure he'll hide you until this is over.
No, Damasin. I won't go if it means leaving the family behind. I'll only go if we all go together. I wouldn't be able to live with myself knowing that you could be killed while I was hiding somewhere.
Damasin looked at me with tears in his eyes. He went and got our father, and they came to talk to me together.
Your brother is right, Immaculée, Dad said. You're a young woman, and it's too dangerous for you here. Go to Pastor Morinzi's house, and in a few days when the troubles are over, I will come and get you myself.
I didn't believe that he'd come and get me because, in my heart, I didn't believe that he was going to survive. So I replied,
But I'd rather stay here with you.
No, you're going into hiding and that's final.
My father ended any further argument.
What about Mom? She should come with me.
I've already asked her, but she won't leave your brothers, he told me.
Within the hour, I was on my way to Pastor Morinzi's house. All I had with me were the clothes on my back, the rosary my father had given to me, and my government-issued identity card that said I was Tutsi. My father followed behind for a short distance. As he turned to go back, he shouted,
"Remember, Immaculée! I will come get you myself!"
It was the last thing he ever said to me. Chapter 7. The Pastor's House. It was a 5-mile hike down a narrow dirt road to the pastor's house. I was exhausted from the last few anguished days, and my head was swimming. Pastor Murinzi stood on his porch, framed by the enormous front door of his big brick home. I'd always thought that his European-style house seemed out of place in a village that had so many huts and tin shacks. It had many bedrooms, a big living and dining room, and 3 bathrooms with real indoor plumbing. And the front yard overflowed with flowers protected from the sun by a huge shade tree.
"It's good to see you again, Immaculée," he said with a smile. "It's been too long."
I'd been good friends with the youngest of the pastor's 10 children since childhood and had visited his house many times. He'd had business dealings with my father over the years, so I'd seen him at our home as well.
"My father told me to come here, Pastor Murinzi,"
I finally said, still gripping his hand.
"He said that he'll come for me as soon as things get better. He promised that he'd come for me himself."
The pastor said nothing, but his eyes spoke volumes. I pushed the pastor's look from my mind, because if I started thinking about harm coming to my family, I'd break down completely. The first person I saw was Buhoro, my teacher from primary school. Although he'd humiliated me during ethnic roll call, I hadn't held a grudge. I was so happy and relieved to see someone I knew that I went straight over to him. I gave him a big smile and put my hand out for him to shake. He looked down at my hand and then up into my eyes, before clicking his tongue in disgust and turning his back on me. I was devastated. I'd never been treated so rudely or with such hostile disrespect, and this from a teacher I'd known since grade school. Everyone in the room witnessed what happened. His body language was unmistakable. I looked around, expecting one of the other adults to come to my defense and chastise Buhoro for his behavior. But no one paid it any attention, not even the pastor, who was standing right in front of us. I'd known for a long time that Buhoro was a Hutu, but it was only now that I realized he was an extremist Hutu who had always hated Tutsis. Extremist. How I hated that word. Once again, Buhoro made me feel ashamed of what God had made me, a Tutsi. I was so embarrassed and humiliated that I had to force myself to greet the other guests before retreating from the room in shame. I was so relieved when I found Janet, my best friend since primary school, sitting in the dining room chatting with another girl. I rushed over and cried, "Janet! Oh, I'm so happy to see you. It's been so horrible for me these past few days. The world has gone crazy. People are being murdered all over the village, and we've been treated like dogs. Thank God you're here. It's so good to see a friendly face." I threw my arms around her, hugging her as tightly as I could, but her body stiffened. When I pulled back and looked into her face, it wasn't friendly at all. In fact, her eyes refused to meet mine. "She's in shock," I thought. "Aren't you feeling well, Janet?" "I haven't been sleeping either, but now we've found each other. My father told me to stay with Pastor Murinzi, but I'm not comfortable here. It's so lucky you're visiting. I'll come home with you and we can keep each other company until things get back to normal." Janet bent down, grabbed her purse, and stood up.
"I don't know what you can be thinking, Immaculée," she said, still not looking at me. "I'm certainly not going to hide you, and neither will my father. We don't hide Tutsis in our home.
She turned to the other girl and said, I'm leaving. And then walked out of the house and never looked back. I staggered into the hall and leaned against the wall. How could my dearest friend turn against me? We'd loved each other like sisters once. How could she be so cruel now? How was it possible for a heart to harden so quickly? Lekim was Pastor Murinzi's youngest son and the closest male friend I'd ever had. We'd known each other since primary school, and because he was great pals with Damasin, he was always hanging around our house, and we'd develop crushes on each other. He even gave me my first kiss just before my 20th birthday. A kiss that was the beginning and end of our romance, because we agreed not to tamper with our wonderful friendship. And now, because of that friendship, I was in a big house with a kind hand on my shoulder, instead of in the fields being hunted by machete-carrying killers.
Come on, Immaculée. Don't be upset. Everyone is behaving strangely today, Lakim said sweetly, patting me tenderly. Come on. I'll take you to my sister's room. The girls will be good to you, Immaculée.
I was so happy that Lakim had found me, but I was terrified and completely unsure if we'd survive. But I had to have faith that God would help us. Otherwise, why would we endure all the suffering, anguish, and betrayal? I lay quietly with my eyes shut. I'd barely slept in days, but I still couldn't nod off. My mind drifted over the events that had led me to the pastor's house. I saw my family sitting around our radio, not knowing what to do.